America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. A great day in a great location. I am here live, obviously. I hope so. At the Reagan Library in Simi Valley, California, where I'm going to be speaking tonight, broadcasting all day today. And we're going to be joined a little bit later by one of President Reagan's most distinguished speechwriters, Peter Robinson of the Hoover Institution. He is the one who wrote the famous Berlin Tear Down That Wall speech. And by the way, it was 32 years ago today that a key moment happened in tearing down that wall. We will play you what some of the news coverage felt like on November 9th of 1989, which was right after President Reagan had left the presidency. But he was very much involved with what happened on that day, something epic in the history that we've experienced during our lifetimes. We're also going to be speaking to Jerry Seib of the Wall Street Journal and finding out something about the Reagan Library and its mission and its message and the message that America needs right now. One of the messages that can be broadcast from here is President Reagan is the most successful example ever of a celebrity in politics. There are other successful examples. Donald Trump was a celebrity who got into politics and became president of the United States. And there's talk that he will run again. Other celebrities, there's a big piece in the Atlantic. It says the forgotten secret of Trump's success. We'll be talking about that and what it is about celebrities that gives them such a profound advantage. We will also be talking about the economy, which is rising just relentlessly. And speaking of relentlessly, there's a relentless determination now, and I think it's correct and accurate and it's right. It's a good thing to do on the part of Republicans who, of course, are planning to take over the House of Representatives, take over the Senate in elections a year from now, to focus on the issue of critical race theory, which is actually just a code word for something else, which is something I'm going to be talking about later tonight as well. That something else is anti-American propaganda, America bashing, demeaning this country. What's in it for people? Why are they so determined to do that? We will take your calls or your comments on that also as the time comes. 1-800-955-1776 is our phone number here. First, let's just go quickly to this idea of the forgotten secret of Trump's success. This is a piece that was published in The Atlantic. It's a piece by Olga Khazan. And she writes, if you define celebrity as initially well-known for something other than politics, the Democrats, the party that once counted the comedian Al Franken, the basketball player Bill Bradley, and the astronaut John Glenn among its elected officials, now have no celebrities among their 20 most well-known or 20 most popular politicians. Aw. Is that striking to you? They have no celebrities? You don't count Adam Schiff as a celebrity? I mean, he certainly is well known. Oh, there are so many other celebrity candidates and celebrity office holders. A longtime senator from Kentucky, Jim Bunning, is a Hall of Fame pitcher. And I remember, because I was a very devoted Philadelphia Phillies fan, when he pitched a no-hitter for the Phillies, and at a time when the Phillies were just woeful, horrible, set the then all-time record. They lost 23 games in a row. If you're a kid, and I was a kid, and a devoted baseball fan, if you have a team that is losing 23 games in a row, I decided to start fasting for a while until they won again, I would have died. I mean, no way. In any event, Jim Bunning didn't lose a lot of games when he was senator from Kentucky. He was a Republican on one of the great Republicans, and actually I think a someone who was very close to President Reagan, was Jack Kemp, who was a pretty outstanding quarterback. The first professional football game I ever saw, it was for the San Diego Chargers, where he was a quarterback. That was in the old American Football League. And he was a congressman from Buffalo. He was a presidential candidate. He was actually the one who started the idea of the Kemp-Roth tax cut, the cutting taxes to get the economy going. And then later, of course, he was a secretary of Housing and Urban Development. So there have been all kinds of celebrities who have had successful political careers. And by the way, they mentioned Bill Bradley, the basketball player. Bill Bradley was a Democrat. He ran against Al Gore in the primaries in the year 2000, Al Gore being, of course, the sitting vice president at the time. Boy, was that ever a boring race. I mean, really, when you think about both Bill Bradley and Al Gore are not burning pyres of explosive charisma. These are guys who are pretty understated. And I remember watching debates when they were in New Hampshire together. And this was a guaranteed insomnia cure. I mean, total reliable insomnia cure. In any event, in this piece in The Atlantic, Olga Khazan goes on and she says that the Democrats have no celebrities in their stable right now. And this is something that they're worried about. Most Americans consume more television than political news, so they see more actors than they do legislators. I think that's deliberate. I mean, I think that people are generally, celebrities are magic, and you don't normally become a celebrity by being a successful politician, though you can do it the other way around. She goes on, Trump was the best-known GOP primary candidate in 2015. 92% of Republicans and independents said they were familiar with him, compared with 81% who said they were familiar with the next best known candidate, who was, what do you think it was back in 2015, 2016? Is it Jeb Bush? Yeah, and basically he was a celebrity because he was the brother of a president and son of another president and governor of Florida, of course. In one 2016 poll, 96% of respondents correctly identified a photo of Trump. Some preliminary research suggests that Trump performed better in the 2016 Republican primary in areas where more people had watched The Apprentice. And I think that's obviously true. One of the reasons that I underestimated Trump, no doubt his possibility of actually winning the nomination when he first announced it, rode down the escalator and made the famous speech, is because I'd never watched The Apprentice. It was never of interest to me. But obviously what it did was it not only made him an appealing celebrity and obviously was a very successful TV show, but it portrayed him in exactly the right light of someone who's trying to do a semi-independent candidacy for presidency. Preliminary research says he performed better with people who had watched The Apprentice, which I think makes sense. As trust in institutions craters, people may look to unconventional candidates for leadership. This is happening all around the world, says Yoon-Ji Kim, a Vanderbilt University political science professor. Ukraine's president, Zelenko, is currently a man who played Ukraine's president on TV. And a boxer and an actor, two different guys, are currently running for president of the Philippines. So who are the prospective celebrity candidates they're talking about for 2022? Who should be? You can call and nominate if you want. 1-800-955-1776. And on the Michael Medved Show, talking about celebrities and politics and speculation in a lengthy Atlantic magazine, where I was just speaking to the group here at the Reagan Library, where I'm broadcasting live today, Simi Valley, California. That in California, we had numerous and very early celebrity candidates. The first candidate, there was a United States Senate candidate who lost to Richard Nixon in 1952, who was a very glamorous Hollywood star named Helen Gahagan. And she was later married to Melvin Douglas. Now, everyone here is much too young to remember any of those names of stars from the 50s. Melvin Douglas was something of a star. His marriage broke up with Congressman Helen Gahagan Douglas, but she was running against this young, dynamic, and very strongly, very passionately, and I think very sincerely anti-communist young veteran, Richard Nixon. And he, and this is one of those things that became like a huge bit of American folklore as Richard Nixon, who was not particularly glamorous, running against Helen Gahagan Douglas, who very much was. He did a leaflet that came out that called her the Pink Lady, that talked about all of her very far left connections. Anyway, Nixon won. And I said 1952. It was 1950 was that Senate race. 1952, he was elected vice president. But there was also a senator who was a very nice guy, not exactly a heavyweight, not one of the most influential senators, but was a star also from the 1950s, who in the 1960s was a U.S. senator. George Murphy was a Republican senator. He at one point, he was doing something together with Senator Hiram Fong of Hawaii, and they said surf and song with Murph and Fong, because they were the two Republican senators at the time on the bordered on the Pacific coast. In any event, television and movies, she says, this is Olga Khazan and writing in Atlantic, shape our politics more than many people realize. Americans watch more TV than people in other rich countries, which, by the way, a lot more, and partially because it's so easily available here and there is so much to choose from. But more and more people, says this Professor Kim of Vanderbilt University, more and more people are opting out of news. Kim estimates that during The Apprentice's heyday, its audience was three times as large as that of the NBC Nightly News, and that before Twitter deleted Trump's account, 69% of The Apprentice's followers on Twitter also followed Trump. Another recent study found that Reagan's tenure as the host of the 1950s TV show, A General Electric Theater, gave him an electoral boost two decades later in the 1976 Republican primaries against Gerald Ford. In Italy, people whose children watched more of former Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi's lowbrow network media set. When they say lowbrow network, this was considered the jiggle network in Italy. And given that it was Italy, there's a whole lot of jiggling going on. And it became more likely to support populist ideas and politicians as adults. A celebrity candidate's brand also matters. Trump's apprentice persona was that of a successful businessman who ushered other Americans into the American dream, a strong pitch for a president, even if it was far from reality. I think they're talking there about The Apprentice. We watched Ronald Reagan do this brilliantly over the course of his political career, says Kostas Panagopoulos, who is a political scientist at Northeastern University. His ability to deliver a speech or to connect with viewers and live audiences was spectacular. And that was part of not only his appeal, but also what allowed him to bring the country together at times when it would have been very difficult for someone who lacked these skills to do so. And again, you have to remember when Reagan ran for governor for the first time in 1966, and he had been known because he made that famous speech, A Time for Choosing, a speech for Barry Goldwater. He's campaigning for Goldwater as the Republican nominee in 1964. And then in 66, but by that time, he was already extremely familiar to people because he had been a movie star already for a quarter century and a very popular and well-liked movie star with several TV shows. He used to do Death Valley Days, which was another sort of Western show that, as a little kid, I actually enjoyed watching. Okay, and here now they talk about the potential candidates that at least the Atlantic magazine sees on the horizon. One of them has been talking about it, and he's been talking back and forth, and he may run, he may not run. Plenty of celebrities have flirted with running for office as Democrats. We are currently living through the Matthew McConaissance, and I think it's his... I was talking about the renaissance of Matthew McConaughey. All right. McConaughey had the number one bestseller for the better part of a year. And his book, which is loopy, and I think Matthew McConaughey is a little bit loopy, but it's interesting, it's well written, and he sold a lot of copies, and he's been talking about running for governor of Texas. And in fact, in trial runs, he's beating Greg Abbott. Greg Abbott, by the way, in trial runs in Texas, he's also running against Beto O'Rourke, who is running. And that's a very tight race. And as I mentioned, Alan West, who was at one time a chairman of the Florida, he was one time congressman from Florida. He's a veteran. He was in the Iraq War. He's African-American, extremely persuasive and charismatic, well-spoken guy. And Alan West is running. He's already announced he's running against Governor Abbott. So they have an incredibly complex situation in Florida, particularly if Matthew McConaughey runs. And he would probably run as an independent, which would could be of some help to Governor Abbott in a race if he's running against Beto O'Rourke and others. In any event, Democrats have also approached the actor and activist Eva Longoria, Greg Popovich, who is a San Antonio Spurs coach, and The Rock, who has talked about running, and perhaps governor of California, perhaps president of the United States. What should this president of the United States do about the fact that China is threatening the whole world right now? We'll talk to Gerald Seib of the Wall Street Journal coming up on the MedVet Show. Michael Medved Show. It is always a pleasure to welcome Gerald Seib to the show, particularly today, because he has a very important column. While Americans are concerned about the implications of the infrastructure bill, which passed, not exactly a messianic event, but very important in the political world. Gerald Seib is the executive editor for the Wall Street Journal, and he was previously the Washington Bureau chief. He's the author of a very relevant book to what we're doing today here, broadcasting from the Reagan Library in Simi Valley, California. His book is called We Should Have Seen It Coming, From Reagan to Trump, A Front Row Seat to a Political Revolution. Gerald... Jerry, it's great to speak to you. First of all, in the aftermath of the not exactly earthquake, of the passage of the infrastructure bill, which there was so much ink spilled on and so much speculation. Doesn't it seem a little bit anticlimactic now that they've decided to put a lot of this $1 trillion into a bunch of new trains?
Well, yes and no. I mean, it does seem to me it's worth remembering that both parties in two administrations, the Trump administration and the Biden administration, have tried for more than 5 years to pass a big infrastructure bill that starts chipping away at the, you know, mountain of problems that there really are with the American infrastructure system. And yeah, a lot of this is going to be kind of the typical stuff that one way or the other Congress funds anyway, you know, build better roads, repair bridges, buy some more train cars, fix the tracks, fix the ports. But there's all kinds of stuff in here that goes beyond that. It involves, you know, building out the internet infrastructure so that people in rural areas and people in poor communities, urban communities, can get internet service. It starts to deal with some of the problems with the power grid. It starts to deal with ways to unclog the freight system so that supply chain problems aren't so acute. So it's still a big deal. The problem with it is that, as you suggest, there has been so much buildup that it feels anticlimactic at this point. And I actually think in some ways that's too bad, because I think it is, you know, it is $1 trillion after all, and even in Washington, that's still big money.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that strikes me is I'm in California now, and I've been following, since I lived in California, which was, I've lived in the Northwest for 26 years now. They have been dealing with the high-speed rail from Merced to Bakersfield, which is it's one of these strange things. And, you know, it makes you think they figured out that apparently the sun is going to burn itself out and everything will go dark about 4 billion years from now, which means they'll have to finish the high-speed rail in the dark. I mean, it's one of those things where Biden, of course, loves trains. And is this actually going to show, do you think, a boost in his approval ratings, or bring the Democratic Party back from the desperation and depression that they seem to feel after the results in Virginia and New Jersey and across the country?
Well, it's going to help. I mean, you know, getting things done helps, and getting things done in a way that people can identify progress has got to help. And, you know, in the medium term, at least, that's going to be what happens here. You know, there's this famous bridge between Ohio and Kentucky that has been falling down for years, and Mitch McConnell wants to rebuild it, and Tim Ryan, who's running for the Senate from Ohio as a Democrat, wants to rebuild it, and they can both go there now and say, hey, we've passed the bill that will actually rebuild this bridge and stop the traffic jams here. That's progress people can identify with. So, yeah, that's going to help. I think Democrats' problems run deeper than that right now, and a lot of their problems have to do with kind of a cultural disconnect with some voters who would like to be with the Democrats and who don't want to be with the party of Trump but aren't really sure they want to be with the, you know, so the AOC version of the Democratic Party. And that transcends an infrastructure bill.
It certainly does. And also what transcends an infrastructure bill, as you make clear in your very important piece in the Journal today, are the moves of China and Russia. What the heck is Russia doing building up these masses of troops and equipment at the border with Ukraine? What's that about?
Well, that is a good question. I think the assumption on the part of most people is that this is an intimidation factor, an intimidation strategy. And the point of it is to intimidate, right? And that's what Putin does well. You bring, you know, thousands and thousands of troops and their armored vehicles to the border, and you make it appear you may invade Ukraine to put a friendly pro-Russian government in place in a country that you used to consider a province of your own country. Probably that's not what's in the cards here. Probably this is an intimidation to stop what has been a kind of a slow drift toward the West in Ukraine. It's also an attempt to show that Vladimir Putin is prepared to use the other big tool at his disposal. And he doesn't have very many tools, but the other one he has at his disposal is natural gas flowing not just to Ukraine, but also all across Europe, and that if he feels aggrieved, he's prepared to turn off the spigot and stop the gas from flowing. And people in Ukraine and the government of Ukraine need to be aware of that. And so, by the way, does everybody else in Europe. So this is probably a classic case of a bully using bullying tactics. And that's bad enough as it is. If it's more than that and he has designs on moving into Ukraine in a real way, then you shouldn't just assume it will all be okay. You need to do something to counter it.
Yeah, and concerning China and their aggressive moves, which you also write about regarding Taiwan, did President Biden miss an opportunity when he was together with so many other world leaders to make a strong statement trying to discourage any Chinese adventurism regarding Taiwan?
That's a good question. You could make the argument that that was an opportunity to make that statement. You could also make the case that that would have been unnecessarily provocative, given that most people think the Chinese are out to move on Taiwan now, but that maybe 5 years from now they will be. And so there's no point in shutting off the conversation with the Chinese right now, because we're not in an imminent in danger of that happening. On the other hand, you know, there was an opportunity to at least say something obliquely about Taiwan. And that wasn't done. One of the things the U.S. has to think about, that the Biden administration has to think about specifically, is whether to make an overt declaration that the U.S. would come to Taiwan's defense if it's attacked by China. There is no such policy in place now. It hasn't been for the last 40 years. The question at the moment is whether the real statement that would get China's attention would be to change that policy, that position, and say that we pledge to help Taiwan if it's attacked by China.
Isn't it an opportunity, when you talk about opportunities, for Republicans who are running for the U.S. Senate in particular and for the House, to talk about support for more military preparedness, to build up a more adequate U.S. response to some of these Chinese investments, in particularly their Navy and other resources?
I think so. And I think that there are a couple of things underway right now. One is a need to repair, if that's the right word, the U.S. military from the damage done by 20 years of kind of grinding counterinsurgency warfare in Iraq and Afghanistan, which, you know, took a toll, has taken a toll, not just on personnel, but on equipment. And that there's a need to kind of rebuild and restock. And that's a legitimate concern. There's also the reality that the U.S. military recognizes that it needs to shift its force structure to one more suitable for confronting China, which means moving away from, you know, low-level counterinsurgency warfare in the Middle East to a kind of a heavier and more high-tech U.S. military force that is specifically designed to put us on a good footing if it comes to conflict with China.
That's Gerald Seib of the Wall Street Journal. Read his excellent piece, its post, and his book, We Should Have Seen It Coming, both posted up at michaelmedved.com. And on the Michael Medved Show from the Reagan Library, and thanks to the throngs that have joined us here, it's a pleasure to have you. It's a bit of a foggy day, but politically, the skies look like they're clearing. There's a powerful piece today, which is actually hilarious, and it's by Gerard Baker. We will get to it in Wall Street Journal. He says, voters decide to make America sane again. And that's kind of a reassuring sentiment. Not so reassuring and not so sane is Roland Martin. I've been on the air with him several times, and he is one of my least favorite people to be on the air with. I would say that. No, Roland can be very obstreperous. And he was not happy at all about what his fellow Democrat, James Carville, said about how wokeness is ruining the Democratic Party. Now, it's obvious. There are innumerable prominent Democrats who say, yeah, James Carville is right. We got shellacked. We got creamed in the elections last week. And believe it or not, that election was a week ago. But Roland Martin doesn't think those comments go very well with his view of things, as he explained on MSNBC. Listen.
But I just got to hear your take on Carville and his comments on woke speak.
I need Carville to shut the F up, because I'm sick of these white men whining and complaining about wokeness when you like it when black folks and Latinos and young white voters and Asians are voting for candidates. How about this, James Carville? How about you go learn how to cut some Lincoln Project type ads with the Democratic Party? How about creating some actual memes? Where's the video this morning touting infrastructure bill? How about you go raise money to run those ads on OAN and Fox News and Newsmax and telling those broke white folks in those various states how the infrastructure bill is going to benefit them. So I'm sorry, James. I need you to shut up and do your job and stop trying to pin it on people who are doing the work.
Well, you know, Roland has strong thoughts. I have to say, I think a lot of us feel that way, though.
Well, this is a wonderful thing, actually, to see Democrats going at each other basically over nothing. By the way, one of the problems, and this is expressed by Matthew Dowd, who's another newly minted Democrat. He used to be a Republican. He was a prominent aide to George W. Bush. He's now the Democratic candidate, not yet the nominee, for lieutenant governor in the wild and woolly Texas election that is coming up a year from now. But the one thing that is striking to me, can we play the beginning of that again? And just think about he talks about he's very bothered, he's sick and tired of white men like James Carville. Can you imagine if somebody had said, I'm sick and tired of black men like Roland Martin? It would be an outrage. And this is one of the problems about the entire use of race as a political tool, is that it's okay if you use it to put down people because they're white. But God forbid, now, of course, this has a whole historical background, and it has the whole history of oppression. And no, there is not a history of oppression of white people as a class for being white. That's not the case in the United States, because white people are still the majority in this country and have been from the beginning. But listen to just the way that Roland Martin begins his particular rant. And nobody stops him, nobody comments on it. And this, it seems to me, has not been the kind of thing that people brought up against Mr. Martin. Listen.
But I just got to hear your take on Carville and his comments on woke speak.
I need Carville to shut the F up, because I'm sick of these white men whining and complaining about wokeness when you
okay,
don't...
That's enough. I'm just sick of these white men. In other words, would it be okay if he was complaining about wokeness and he was a black guy? Would it be okay if he was a Hispanic guy? It seems to me that's amazing. Then Matthew Dowd, who I mentioned, was on MSNBC with Nicole Wallace, talking about whether or not this subject, the subject of wokeness, really is having a negative impact on the Democratic Party. I think it clearly is. Listen, this is Matthew Dowd.
James Carville, in the wake of Election Day last week, blaming Democrats' wokeness as the reason for their losses across the board and starting a conversation, a very, very vibrant one, about how exactly Democrats have lost some of the good things they had going for them. As Congressman Conley said earlier in this program, 13-point swing since 1 year ago. Seemingly as a reaction to part of that conversation, our friend Matt Dowd chimed in yesterday on Twitter, tweeting this, quote, as they sat in church today, I was thinking, if Jesus were here today, he would be accused of being woke How about we just say it is human decency to treat all with respect and dignity, and that it is constitutional to say all men and women are equal? So I want to try to nail you down on where you come down on. I think this is probably not a very helpful debate to have about wokeness, but I wonder what you think.
Okay, and here is what Dowd has to say. Listen.
Well, first, I don't ever think it's a really good thing to, for old white guys to use the term woke, right, and frame the reference of that. To me, this is like, it's another thing like critical race theory, right? Like, people say this word, and it's taken on a pejorative, but it doesn't, there's like, nobody knows what it means that's accusing other people of it. The only people that this seems to be a fire about is, again, in their sort of right-wing infrastructure ecosystem here and there. But Democrats need to get back to just using the common values that every American connects to, and that's the conversation we need to have in the course of this. I don't think Terry McAuliffe lost Virginia because of the woke culture in all of this. He probably, in my view, lost more because he talked about Donald Trump too much. I think that's what the problem with the voters have right now is they want to have this battle on election. In their mind, Donald Trump is yesterday, even though we all know he sort of surfaces in this. But they want to know your candidacy versus the other person. What's the difference and what are you going to do in my life? Quit talking about Donald Trump.
Look, I think he's right about McAuliffe cooked his own goose by trying to make the race against Trump. Because frankly, that ensured that the Trump voters, of whom there were still millions who were enthusiastic in Virginia. I mean, yes, Trump lost Virginia by 10 points to Biden in the presidential election. Doesn't mean he don't have a lot of people who are very devoted to President Trump and like him a lot. And the fact that Terry McAuliffe mentions his name every 14 seconds helped to turn out some of those Trump voters. This is one of those things that people are amazed about, is that McAuliffe running against Youngkin actually got more votes in an off-year election, a gubernatorial election. He got more votes than Trump did for president. And that's partially because he got Trump's voters, thanks to Terry McAuliffe, and he played add-on with that. There's this piece also on the same subject called Voters Decide to Make America Sane Again, a good piece by Gerard Baker. He says, to the many people around the world who admire America and want her to succeed, watching events in this country over the past few years has been a little like observing a dear friend going through a mental health crisis. Ouch. Many of the symptoms of a full psychiatric breakdown have been on display. Denial of objective reality, wild mood swings, episodes of paranoia, delusional thinking, and grandiose ideation, a tendency toward lacerating self-harm. And then he talks about all of these things and how they were displayed. And Gerard Baker's been a big supporter of President Trump. What he's talking about has been what the country was like on both sides, and including, yes, the obsession on the Democratic side with trying to prove the Russian collusion narrative, an obsession that now has largely fallen apart because of some of the indictments in the Durham investigation. We will get to this. We will also be talking to Peter Robinson about how a president can change the world. Ronald Reagan did it. And is it so impossible? I mean, it looks like it's out of reach for the current incumbent. But when you think about a potential president actually shaking up the country in a good way, should that be impossible to imagine? Not when you think about our history in this greatest nation on God's green earth.
Have you heard about vine-to-bar chocolate? It's the winemaker's chocolate, the world's first